Portrait of a Lady by Henry James. Under certain circumstances, there are few hours in life more agreeable than the hour dedicated to the ceremony known as afternoon tea. There are circumstances in which, whether you partake of the tea or not, some people, of course, never do, the situation is in itself delightful. Those that I have in mind in beginning to unfold this simple history afforded an admirable setting to an innocent pastime. The implements of the little feast had been disposed upon the lawn of an old English country house, in what I should call the perfect middle of a splendid summer afternoon. Part of the afternoon had waned, but much of it was left, and what was left was of the finest and rarest quality. Real dusk would not arrive for many hours, but the flood of summer light had begun to ebb. The air had grown mellow. The shadows were long upon the smooth, dense turf. They lengthened slowly, however, and the scene expressed that sense of leisure still to come, which is perhaps the chief source of one's enjoyment of such a scene at such an hour. From 5 o'clock to 8 is on certain occasions a little eternity. But on such an occasion as this, the interval could be only an eternity of pleasure. The persons concerned in it were taking their pleasure quietly, and they were not of the sex which is supposed to furnish the regular votaries of the ceremony I have mentioned. The shadows on the perfect lawn were straight and angular. They were the shadows of an old man, sitting in a deep wicker chair near the low table on which the tea had been served, and of two younger men strolling to and fro in desultory talk in front of him. The old man had a cup in his hand. It was an unusually large cup, of a different pattern from the rest of the set, and painted in brilliant colors. He disposed of its contents with much circumspection, holding it for a long time close to his chin, with his face turned to the house. His companions had either finished their tea or were indifferent to their privilege. They smoked cigarettes as they continued to stroll. One of them, from time to time, as he passed, looked with a certain attention at the elder man, who, unconscious of observation, rested his eyes upon the rich red front of his dwelling. The house that rose beyond the lawn was a structure to repay such consideration, and was the most characteristic object in the peculiarly English picture I have attempted to sketch. It stood upon a low hill above the river being the Thames, at some 40 miles from London. A long gabled front of red brick, with a complexion of which time and the weather had played all sorts of pictorial tricks, only, however, to improve and refine it, presented to the lawn its patches of ivy, its clustered chimneys, its windows smothered in creepers. The house had a name and a history. The old gentleman taking his tea would have been delighted to tell you these things. How it had been built under Edward VI, had offered a knight's hospitality to the great Elizabeth, whose august person had extended itself upon a huge, magnificent, and terribly angular bed, which still formed the principal honour of the sleeping apartments, had been a good deal bruised and defaced in Cromwell's wars, and then, under the Restoration, repaired and much enlarged, and how, finally, after having been remodelled and disfigured in the 18th century, it had passed into the careful keeping of a shrewd American banker, who had bought it originally because, owing to circumstances too complicated to set forth, it was offered at a great bargain. Bought it with much grumbling at its ugliness, its antiquity, its incommodity, and who now, at the end of 20 years, had become conscious of a real aesthetic passion for it, so that he knew all its points, and would tell you just where to stand to see them in combination, and just the hour when the shadows of its various protuberances, which fell so softly upon the warm, weary brickwork, were of the right measure. Besides this, as I have said, he could have counted off most of the successive owners and occupants, several of whom were known to general fame. Doing so, however, with an undemonstrative conviction that the latest phase of its destiny was not the least honorable. The front of the house overlooking that portion of the lawn with which we are concerned was not the entrance front. This was in quite another quarter. Privacy here reigned supreme, and the wide carpet of turf that covered the level hilltop seemed but the extension of a luxurious interior. The great still oaks and beeches flung down a shade as dense as that of velvet curtains. And the place was furnished like a room, with cushioned seats, with rich-colored rugs, with the books and papers that lay upon the grass. The river was at some distance, where the ground began to slope, the lawn, properly speaking, ceased. But it was nonetheless a charming walk down to the water. The old gentleman at the tea-table, Mr. Touchett, who had come from America 30 years before, was neatly dressed, but a shawl was folded upon his knees. A beautiful collie dog lay upon the grass near his chair, watching his master's face, and a little bristling, bustling terrier bestowed a desultory attendance upon the other gentleman. One of these was a remarkably well-made man of 35. This person had a certain fortunate, brilliant, exceptional look, the air of a happy temperament, fertilized by a high civilization, which would have made almost any observer envy him at a venture. His companion, measuring the length of the lawn beside him, was a person of quite a different pattern, who would not, like the other, have provoked you to wish yourself almost blindly in his place. He looked clever and ill, a combination by no means felicitous. His gait had a shambling, wandering quality. He was not very firm on his legs. Whenever he passed the old man in the chair, he rested his eyes upon him. And at this moment, with their faces brought into relation, you would easily have seen that they were father and son. "Are you cold?" the son inquired. The father slowly rubbed his legs.
"Well, I don't know. I can't tell till I feel."
"Perhaps someone might feel for you," said the younger man, laughing.
"Oh, I hope someone will always feel for me. Don't you feel for me, Lord Warburton?"
"Oh, yes, immensely," said the gentleman addressed as Lord Warburton promptly. "I'm bound to say you look wonderfully comfortable."
"Well, I suppose I am, in most respects."
And the old man looked down at his green shawl and smoothed it over his knees.
"The fact is, I've been comfortable for so many years that I suppose I've got so used to it I don't know it."
"Yes, that's the bore of comfort," said Lord Warburton. "We only know when we're uncomfortable."
"It strikes me we're rather particular," his companion remarked.
"Oh, yes, there's no doubt we're particular," Lord Warburton murmured. "The ladies will save us," said the old man. "That is, the best of them will, for I make a difference between them. Make up to a good one and marry her, and your life will become much more interesting."
"If I marry an interesting woman, I shall be interested. Is that what you say?" Lord Warburton asked.
"You may fall in love with whomsoever you please," said the old man. "But you mustn't fall in love with my niece."
"I haven't the honor of knowing your niece," Lord Warburton said. "I think it's the first time I've heard of her."
"She's a niece of my wife's. Mrs. Touchett brings her to England."
Then young Mr. Touchett explained.
"My mother, you know, has been spending the winter in America, and we're expecting her back. She writes that she has discovered a niece, and that she has invited her to come out with her."
"I see. Very kind of her," said Lord Warburton. "Is the young lady interesting?"
"We hardly know more about her than you. My mother has not gone into details. She chiefly communicates with us by means of telegrams, and my mother has thoroughly mastered the art of condensation. Changed hotel. Very bad. Impudent clerk. Taken sister's girl. Died last year. Go to Europe. Quite independent." "Over that, my father and I have scarcely stopped puzzling. It seems to admit of so many interpretations."
"When does Mrs. Touchett arrive?" asked Lord Warburton.
"We're quite in the dark. She may already have disembarked in England."
"In that case, she would probably have telegraphed to you."
"She never telegraphs when you would expect it. Only when you don't," said the old man. "She likes to drop on me suddenly."
While this exchange took place, Ralph Touchett wandered away a little. His face was turned toward the house, but his eyes were bent musingly on the lawn, so that he had been an object of observation to a person who had just made her appearance in the ample doorway for some moments before he perceived her. The person in question was a young lady, a tall girl in a black dress, who at first sight looked pretty. Meantime, the other two gentlemen had also taken note of the newcomer.
"Dear me, who's that strange woman?" Mr. Touchett had asked.
"Perhaps it's Mrs. Touchett's niece, the independent young lady," Lord Warburton suggested.
"But where's my wife, then?" murmured the old man.
"I suppose the young lady has left her somewhere. That's a part of the independence. The girl spoke to Ralph, smiling. I ought to tell you that I'm probably your cousin. Ralph looked at her a moment. She was unexpectedly pretty, and seemed to have a great deal of confidence in herself. Probably, the young man exclaimed, laughing. I supposed it was quite settled. Have you arrived with my mother?
Yes, half an hour ago, and she told me that if I should see you, I was to say to you that you must come to her in her room at 7:15.
The young man looked at his watch. Thank you very much. I shall be punctual. And then he looked at his cousin. Won't you come and make acquaintance with my father? Ralph ventured to ask. Old Mr. Touchett slowly got up from his chair to introduce himself.
Mother has arrived, said Ralph, and this is Miss Archer.
The old man gallantly kissed her.
It's a great pleasure to me to see you here, but I wish you had given us a chance to receive you.
She was looking all around her, at the lawn, the great trees, the silvery Thames, the beautiful old house.
I've never seen anything so beautiful as this.
It's looking very well, said old Mr. Touchett.
There are many much better houses, said Ralph.
Don't say that, my son, the old man protested. There's nothing better than this.
I've got a very good one. I think in some respects it's rather better, said Lord Warburton,
who as yet had not spoken, but who had kept an attentive eye upon Miss Archer.
I should like very much to show it to you, he added.
Ralph Touchett was a philosopher, but nevertheless he knocked at his mother's door at 7:15 with a good deal of eagerness. Even philosophers have their preferences, and it must be admitted that of his progenitors, his father ministered most to his sense of the sweetness of filial dependence. His father, as he had often said to himself, was the more motherly. His mother, on the other hand, was paternal. He found her completely dressed for dinner, but she embraced her boy with her gloved hands and made him sit on the sofa beside her. She inquired scrupulously about her husband's health and about the young man's own, and receiving no very brilliant account of either, remarked that she was more than ever convinced of her wisdom in not exposing herself to the English climate.
"And now tell me about the young lady," he said to his mother. "What do you mean to do with her?"
Mrs. Touchett was prompt.
"I mean her to stay 3 or 4 weeks here at Garden Court, and then I shall invite her to spend the autumn with me in Florence."
"You don't rise above detail, dear mother," said Ralph.
"I should like to know what you mean to do with her in a general way."
"My duty," Mrs. Touchett declared.
"Ah, dear mother, one always knows what to expect of you. You've never surprised me but once, and that was today, presenting one with a pretty cousin whose existence I never suspected." "Do you think her so very pretty?"
"Very pretty indeed.
But it's her general air of being someone in particular that strikes me. Who is this rare creature, and what is she? Where did you find her, and how did you make her acquaintance?"
"I found her in an old house at Albany, sitting in a dreary room on a rainy day, reading a heavy book and boring herself to death. You know, I had seen nothing of my sister's children for years. I disapproved entirely of the father. But I always meant to do something for them when he should have gone to his reward. There are two others of them, both of whom are married, but I saw only the elder. She jumped at the idea of my taking an interest in Isabel. She said it was just what her sister needed, that someone should take an interest in her. She spoke of her as you might speak of some young person of genius, in want of encouragement and patronage. It may be that Isabel's a genius, but in that case I've not yet learned her special line."
Ralph had listened attentively to this judicious report.
"Ah, if she's a genius," he said, "we must find out her special line. Is it by chance for flirting?"
"I don't think so. You may suspect that at first, but you'll be wrong. You won't, I think, in any way be easily right about her."
"Warburton's wrong, then," Ralph rejoicingly exclaimed. "He flatters himself he has made that discovery at first glance."
His mother shook her head.
"Lord Warburton won't understand. He needn't try."
"He's very intelligent," said Ralph.
"But it's right he should be puzzled once in a while."
"Isabel will enjoy puzzling a lord,"
Mrs. Touchett remarked. Her son frowned a little.
"What does she know about lords?"
"Nothing at all. That will puzzle him all the more."